Chapter 4. St. Swithin's. In September 1962, the reconditioned engine of the Ford Anglia purred out of action in front of College Hall, St. Swithin's Hospital Medical School. I ordered Chapman, my father, to carry my trunk up to my room and went to a nearby inn while he and his wife unpacked my belongings and tidied up the room for my arrival. I left the pub at 3:30, walked back through the courtyard, past a lot of rather spotty ex-grammar school boys, absolute oiks, the lot of them, strolled up to my room and dismissed my parents. I cast my eyes round the room. The bed looked too narrow. I tested it for creakiness and made a mental note to tell the porter to bring me a larger and less creaky place to sleep. On the desk, a Bakelite version of Birdseye Maple, I noticed something wrapped in greaseproof paper, which is a piece of paper soaked in lard. I unwrapped the package. It was a cake from my mother. How sweet, I thought, as I threw it into the waste paper basket. I opened up a small suitcase containing my books. Climbing in Snowdonia, Nanga Parbat, The Ascent of K2, Cambridge University in the Andes, The Art of Coarse Rugby, and I'll Teach You Drinking. I flicked through a few pages of this volume and came to St. Swithin's Hospital. It had 3 stars by it. To supplement my meagre student grant, I decided to do some cabaret. Full of confidence, being ex-footlights, Tony Hendra and myself went along to the Blue Angel nightclub for an audition. We chose the Blue Angel because it was one of the best nightclub spots for review, and we'd read in The Stage, in an advertisement that sounded like whistling in the dark, how David Frost had recently been retained there for a second glorious month. However, we were accepted at the audition, and in 2 weeks' time we found ourselves top of the bill, which meant we didn't start our act until any time from 2 to 2:30 a.m., meaning that I didn't get back to college until 3:30, having to get up again at 8:30 in time for a ward round at 9. I found this routine too grueling after 5 more weeks, and we left the Blue Angel, to be followed by a promising newcomer called Dave Allen. I wasn't just at St. Swithin's Hospital to perform late-night cabarets and West End reviews. I also helped to start annual concerts for the Hippocrat Society and organise the Christmas ward shows. The last was a splendid excuse for avoiding a family Christmas. I could join in with the rest of the lads wandering around the wards, entertaining the moribund with liberal supplies of barrels of beer made portable by the use of hospital trolleys. Some of the nursing staff, the huge matron in particular, raised objections to these festive revels in that they were disruptive of hospital routine and, in certain cases where beds were trampled on by spectators, deleterious to the well-being of the patients. But if I were ill enough to need to be in hospital over Christmas, I can think of no better atmosphere in which to peg out. Nurses wearing silly hats, urine bottles decorated with holly, mistletoe on the drip stands, general bacchanalia. Apart from the entertainment, there was yet another side to medicine. I was used to dead bodies, but now I had to deal with live human beings. This was another hurdle to overcome. And I remember on my first day as a dresser, we were taught by the houseman how to take blood from patients. He suggested that we should all take blood from each other and lined us up in pairs so that you would take 5 mil from your partner, who would then take 5 mil of blood from you. Fortunately, he left and we were left on our own. I refused to have my blood taken by the idiot who was my partner, and I'm sure he felt the same about me. I arrived alone at the ward the next morning at 8:30 to find that I had to take what amounted to about a pint of blood from 9 different patients. And, as everyone knows, in a hospital, if you complain, you get worse treatment, less attention, and an ice-cold enema. The next couple of weeks I spent pretending to look like a doctor while looking at people's feces and staring into their sputum jars. There was one particular patient whom the nurses had finally refused to bath. His abdominal surgery had been mismanaged at another hospital, and he'd been brought into the teaching hospital to be sorted out. His abdomen had been covered with aluminium paste in an attempt to prevent the excoriation of the skin caused by his 5 substitute arseholes. It was as though his bowels had been doctored by a telephone engineer. Any competent plumber would have done a better job. No one really knew which hole led anywhere. Marcus Pine and myself, as dressers, were ordered by the sister to bath him. We put him into a bath, which we filled with disinfectant, and were both vaguely nauseated by the unformed turds which slipped out of his orifices. He was pleased by the comfort of the bath and the fact that we hadn't thrown up in his presence. We dried him and carried him back to bed, and he died the next morning. John Cleese, who had just finished his finals in Cambridge, getting a rather snooty upper second, wanted somewhere to stay in London while he wrote for BBC Radio, such things as You'll Be Surprised, a Christmas show for Dick Emery. I was very friendly with the junior warden, Buzz Mangrove, and had managed to find a passkey to all of the rooms in the Hall of Residence on the black market, and I knew that there were several empty ones. I gave John the key and suggested that he should stay in the room normally occupied by a person called Nick Spratt. Now, Nick Spratt was a direct but distant descendant of Sir Percival Spratt, the first surgeon to be really a surgeon rather than a barber. Buzz Mangrove mentioned to me that perhaps Mr. Cleese should begin to think of finding alternative accommodation. Buzz at this time was 5'1", and I've no reason to believe that he's grown any bigger now. And apart from being junior warden at the hospital, he was senior registrar to the man called the Beast. The Beast was senior surgeon and stood 6'5", with no shoes and excluding bright red hair, which meant that Buzz, during operations, had to stand on a box. The Beast would do anything. He was the last of the heroic surgeons. He would inspire such confidence in his ability that patients would practically plead to have their entire livers taken out by him. I remember one day, most particularly when the Beast was operating, and he told Buzz that he had a malignant melanoma, an extremely nasty kind of cancer, on his own big toe. Immediately, he climbed up onto the table and asked Buzz to amputate it. Buzz didn't want to do this, but the Beast insisted he was right. The toe was removed, and the report came back from pathology reading blood blister. My sexual life at St. Swithin's consisted of going to bed with women while dreaming about men. This is hardly even partly true in retrospect. It's just that I definitely do remember, once or twice, thoughts of men's bodies creeping into my mind while in coitus. Only that sort of thing just doesn't make for neat sentences. The first one was the student's traditional friend, a nurse. A sack of flour that you met at the hop and persuaded back to your room for coffee, having put all the chairs in a friend's room so that the only seating accommodation is the bed. She was rather podgy and extremely repellent, but I just wanted to get my end away. She must have been some kind of descendant of Richard Gordon's rigor mortis. Perhaps her mother was a nurse at St. Swithin's in about 1939. She was a real lie-down-and-think-of-hockey-and-England type, and after a brief grope that was not enthusiastically received, I thought, the bar's still open, I'll get rid of her. She said, it's too late now, matron says we must be in by 10:30. Was this some kind of devious come-on? I looked her hard in the breasts and thought, yuck. I politely pushed her out of the room, across the square to the hospital, and over the traditional nurses' hostel entrance, the mortuary gate. Then I ran back to the bar. There was another female student. We had noticed each other across tables filled with sard loddon meals. She was getting a lot of attention from the lads, but of a rather fawning, not daring to ask nature. It was, can I carry your books home time? She was drooled over constantly. With very good legs, small but well-formed tits, she was at least as intelligent as Alexis de Tocqueville, Alexander Graham Bell and Alec Plitt put in a box. And so, on an idyllic summer afternoon, it was tea time in the student's refectory, I sat down at her table. Ignoring her minions, I boldly passed her a plate of sandwich spread sandwiches and asked her if she'd go. She was intelligent enough to say, see you in my room tonight, with none of this pointless preamble of going out to dinner, sitting in cinemas holding sweaty hands, love letters and all that timid avoidance of the real issue. We had a bloody good time for a whole year. She was athletic and imaginative. We went right through the card. It wasn't just British missionary, but doggy on the floor standing, on the desk, in the shower, in the bath, near the bath, at someone else's place while they weren't looking, and in a guard's van through the whole of Birmingham. I liked the experience, but after about 9 months or so, it began to pall, and I felt I would rather spend more time in the bar drinking with the lads, hoping to be too late back in my room for the hello, I'm lonesome telephone call. For a bit of variation one night, I tried the wife of a student who'd been foolish enough to get married. She had about 3 children then, but she was still raring to go. She had large knockers and a very thorough knowledge of what dongs like. Her husband was a friend of Buzz Mangrove and was pissed out of his mind in the bar, but Buzz had noticed her absence and suspected me. He didn't interrupt, but listened outside my door as I came between her breasts for the second time. The description of this passage has made me feel... excuse me. That's better. After all this frenzied activity, I decided that I should do some clinical tests on myself. So whenever I went in a taxicab, tube, train or bus, I looked at each passerby and tried to tell myself honestly which ones I would like to go to bed with. And the ratio of boys to girls was something like 7 to 3, which puts me clearly on the homosexual side of the scale as suggested in the Kinsey report. I was largely homosexual and worried about it. A trip to New Zealand and America made me a little more broad-minded about myself, and immediately after qualifying I gave up medicine and became a raging poof. But no mincing, a butch one with a pipe. There are lots more memories of St. Swithin's hospitals, and I'll tell you one of them. As a medical student at that time, you were required to drag out at least 20 babies on your own and sew up the results of your errors. I went to St. Clive's Hospital in the south of London for 4 weeks, and my fellow student there was called David Sadza. We shared a room. He, through no fault of God's, happened to be black and I white. The staff nurse in midwifery, I blame her for this, happened to be South African and very white. So David did about 4 deliveries to my 40. He was quite simply never asked, because blacks could not be trusted. He was not even allowed to do the sewing up after an episiotomy. An episiotomy, incidentally, means cutting through the labia and perineal musculature to ease the passage of the probably unwanted infant into a life it didn't ask for. I became quite good at sewing up vaginas. I suppose it was because I was thinking of their past and future contents. But I was rather annoyed. A new regulation had just come into force, allowing midwives to do episiotomies, so that they were keen to do one whenever they could. They were not allowed to do the stitching, so students like G. Chapman were disturbed every half hour to repair their messy work, which meant that I kept missing David Frost's not-so-much-a-programme, more-a-way-of-life. There was a patient I once examined just before the programme. I thought she was in labour and likely to give birth soon. The South African midwife, who had already accused me of losing the keys to the drug cupboard, said, "No, she isn't. She's only 14 and hasn't got any pains." I informed her that pains, and her age for that matter, were quite irrelevant, and that all the signs, including the contractions, showed that she was definitely in the first stage of labour. The midwife said nonsense, and I went back to watch the programme. Just as Bernd Levin was about to say something very interesting to Harvey Orkin, I got bleeped. I ran up to the labour ward, and while I was scrubbing up, the girl gave birth. The midwives panicked. I gave the girl her child after the formality of tying off the umbilical cord and weighed the placenta. She asked me my name, and in gratitude called the placenta Graham, though the child had to be called Alvar after its father. It was the easiest birth I've ever seen, perhaps because she was so young and had none of the fear and worry that is commonly induced by older members of the female sex in order to dramatise their role in life. I've always thought of birth as one of the most natural processes and not one needing the interference of medical science. Most women in the world have their babies behind a bush in a squatting position, in which even a breech delivery can be performed by one person without unnatural interference. For male readers, imagine being 9 months constipated, having inadvertently swallowed a coconut whole, and then being asked to lie on an operating table, legs apart, with lots of people watching dressed in silly clothes. Would you be able to shit? In my view, maternity wards should consist of carefully arranged shrubberies with earplugs for each mother so they don't have to hear, "Oh, I had a terrible time with my first. Wrong way round, is it, dear? Oh, poor thing, 25 stitches I had the last time. Oh, they've got you on a drip, have they?" Childbirth would be completely painless if grandmothers had their lips sewn up. And if anyone ever says to you, "I didn't go through all that agony to bring you into the world for this," either 1, run away, 2, punch them in the teeth, or 3, say, "Don't give me that, you fucking cow. If you want to go and work in a pit hacking out fucking coal all day, you bloody well can." I got fed up with having to sew up so many unnecessary incisions and annoyed at the South African staff nurse's attitude towards my friend. One night, after I'd just finished sewing up a patient, he was called to a delivery. The South African nurse refused to allow him into the theatre, and I was called. I arrived to find a perfectly natural birth in progress and was told by the South African nurse that Mr. Sadza had refused to do an episiotomy. I said that I agreed with him. There didn't seem to be any need for one, but the harridan kept advancing with a pair of scissors. I said, "No, this one's all right." The baby's head had already stretched the vagina, and it seemed obvious that it would come out without any help or damage to the mother. She insisted it wouldn't, and again approached the labia with her scissors. I hit her on the jaw with my elbow, and she fell to the floor. I was keeping my hands sterile for the delivery of an intact baby. The baby was born from an unscathed vagina. This was as much a relief to me as to the mother. The medico-legal complications of a split perineum combined with an assaulted midwife would not have been paltry in the least.